when I'm whispering, I suddenly makes me question like everything. I'm like, that word's really weird. And so just then I'm like, 12th is such a weird word.
12th is a weird word. It is a strange word. There's like an F in there.
Well, when I show the kids the like the number 12, they all go 20. And I'm like, no. But no, I do understand that. 12, 20, like, you know.
It's like in French, there's deux, which means two. And there's douze, which means 12. And it's easy if you like accidentally say do instead of de, it sounds like douze. So it's easy to screw that up. All right, so
it's been a while.
Get into it. We recorded like exactly a month ago. We did Anne of Brittany.
Oh wow.
But anyway, we'll get into it. So bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all of the kings and emperors of France, from Clovis to Napoleon III.
Who will be selected as the creme de la creme, and who will be sent to the guillotine?
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers.
And as Eliza and I were just saying, it's been like a month since we recorded, which has been a while since we've had a gap like this.
Yeah, I know.
We last did Anne of Brittany. That was our last person. Who's in between two of our kings, that she married both of them. And we're now doing her second husband, Louis the 12th, who I will try not to call Louis the 11th. Try my hardest, because I've always wanted to say 11th. Louis the 11th just sort of rolls off the tongue, I guess.
Don't worry, it's like, I just turned 27, but for some reason, all of last year when I was 26 and people kept asking how old I was, I wanted to say 27. So now I feel like I've been 27 for 2 years.
I wish I'd been 27 for 2 years. I'm 28 now. Yay. I'm a year older, as we record this. But at least I'm not in the 27 club with Eliza and a bunch of people who have died recently.
Yeah.
On the podcast, at
least. Amy Winehouse.
Charles VIII was 27. And
Amy Winehouse. In those Nights of France.
Yeah, no, but I'm trying to think of people we've done. And there was another one before that. I can't remember who it was. Not Anne of Brittany. She was 37. Now, first of all, shout out to new patrons. We've got some new patrons.
Oh, yay.
By the way, sorry if we are very late getting to these. It's just re-recording, like, sort of in advance.
It's been a while.
So we've got Louisa White has just joined the Boudoir, where people can find our spin-off Mistress series. Got Katerina, who's also joined the Boudoir. We've got Ursula, who's joined Economy Plus, where you get all of the bonus content, including our recent episode on The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And we've also got Kate Domingo, who is our newest VIP member.
Woo! Clap, 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 clap.
He's given that little extra bit, and you get special recommendation privileges from that. So, welcome, guys. We appreciate that very much. All women by the looks of it, which is great because it is Women's History Month. Just saying.
Yes.
So, also, we're moving into the 16th century, so we're doing a Patreon bonus on Katerina Sforza as well.
Yay.
So that's going to be our next Patreon episode.
Yeah, and then I can finally read her book.
Yeah. And then after that, we'll be getting to the Mistresses of Francis I.
Oh yeah, going back to the Mistresses. It's been a while.
During that, or same time as that, I guess, we'll also be talking about probably Leonardo da Vinci at some point. I want to talk about him.
Obviously.
Or at least his time in France, I guess. Just that bit of his life.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just agreeing with you.
Okay. As you should. Because I'm always right. Except when I say make lemons out of lemonade, that's when I'm not right. Remember, I did that like 5 times last episode. Okay, so that will all be on Patreon. So go there if you want to hear more Battle Royale. Even more.
Yes.
There's too much of it at this point. So going into the 16th century, we will be also be doing little spotlights on figures like John Calvin, who's this like Swiss preacher who pretty much started the French Protestant Reformation.
Oh.
And if there are any other interesting side characters that you guys want us to put a special spotlight on as well, please let us know.
Recommendation.
Join us on Patreon so that you can recommend it. So let's finally get into Louis,
mm-hmm.
our current Louis. But before we get into Louis, a bit about his parents. Yes.
Okay.
Because his parents aren't the King and Queen of France.
Yes.
However, we have covered his father in an episode, because his father is Charles, Duke of Orleans, who got Regency of Madness episode, going all the way back to the Regency of Madness. And the reason why that's so far, like, away in the past now is because Charles, Duke of Orleans was 68 years old when his son Louis was born.
Oh, wow.
So it's a real, like, generation jump for Louis, yeah. So Charles was born in 1394, and Louis's going to die more than 100 years after his father is born, which is kind of wild.
Oh, after his father's born, sorry. I was thinking, like, in my head, he lived to death, and I was like, he lived to over 100?
No, no, no. So Charles born in 1394, which is the same year when you know, the madness started for his uncle, King Charles VI, or around the same time. We don't have to get too far into Charles's life story because, again, we've covered it in an episode. And Veronica Fortune on Past Podcast has an entire 5-part mini-series about him as well. So I'd recommend people check that out as well. So we've been calling this guy Charles the Poet because, as well as being a duke, he's also one of the 15th century's most celebrated poets.
Nice.
At least in the French language.
Do we still have his poetry? Like,
yeah. And on Veronica's episodes, she actually has snippets of the poetry as well. So I'd recommend you guys. But yeah, we still have his poetry. And at the time of his birth, his uncle, Charles the Sixth, the mad one, sat on the French throne. And after the murder of Charles's father, Louis I of Orleans, who's murdered by the Burgundians, if we remember, he and his mother, Valentina Visconti, were involved in a bitter dispute against John the Fearless of Burgundy, whilst also trying to navigate France through the Hundred Years' War as well. And there was a brief cessation of hostilities so that the French could actually fight the English for a change. During this part of the conflict, Charles in 1415 was captured at the Battle of Agincourt, and he spent the next 25 years in prison. Upon Charles's return, fighters like the Bastard of Orleans, his brother, Arthur de Richemont, and of course Joan of Arc had sort of turned the tide of the Hundred Years' War. And also Charles's English contacts ended up being quite useful in the diplomatic process going forward, as well as an unlikely friendship with the new Duke of Burgundy, Philip the Good. I mean, call it a friendship. It's you know, a business association, alliance. I suppose. It's an alliance, yes.
Transaction.
Yeah. And the alliance is solidified when Charles ends up marrying Philip the Good's niece, whose name is Marie of Cleves. And yes, that is the same Cleves as Anne of Cleves. Marie of Cleves was actually his third wife. His first wife had died before his imprisonment. That was Isabella of Valois. And his second wife, Bonne of Armagnac, he'd barely known her before he was imprisoned. And then she died while he was in prison. So this is the third wife.
Not much luck.
That he's got. Yeah, not much luck. He does have a daughter. He has one daughter called Joan. Although she dies, she also dies when he's in prison as well. So it's like not great luck. So he's kind of starting fresh with Marie. And meanwhile, the Hundred Years' War is wrapping up. A lot of that is thanks to Charles and his like negotiating. Charles's ransom had been so huge that he had to mortgage a lot of his property and like sell a lot of his estates and stuff. So the Principality of Orléans ends up quite shrunken by the end of Charles the Poet's life. So Louis, despite being kind of like the first prince of the realm, he's kind of like, as we'll see, the next in line if the main royal family dies out, inherits surprisingly little.
Yeah.
So Louis was born at one of Charles's few remaining properties, the Chateau de Blois, the ancestral home of the Valois Dukes of Orléans, on the night of the 27th of June of 1462.
How old was she?
So Marie of Cleves was in her 30s at this point.
So
she's about half Charles's age, but They've been trying for kids for like a long time, and they'd given up on having a son at this point, actually. So it was rather a miraculous sort of birth.
And the miracle baby.
They'd had a daughter called Anne, because we needed another Anne. They had a daughter called Marie, because we need another Marie. So this is Marie Jr. Yeah. But then after Louis, they have another daughter called Anne as well.
MJ.
So need another Anne. So it's M. So, but yeah, it was considered a miraculous sort of burst in fertility, one might say, for Marie of Cleves, to the extent that Louis the 11th, the king at the time, he'd just become king, let this little speculation go that, like, maybe it's not his son, actually. But historians generally agree that there was no shenanigans going on, and Louis was just a bit of a gossip monger, as we know. King Louis, at least.
Can't blame him.
By the way, I will, for this episode, I will call Louis the 11th the Universal Spider, or the Spider King.
Good.
The Tudoriferous podcast, when they did Louis the 12th, they did that because it was just easier rather than saying Louis, so Louis, Louis.
Louis.
Yeah, because I did notice at one point in the Anne of Brittany episode, I was just saying Louis without distinctions. So I will do my best to... So the subject of this episode is Louis, and the subject of a few episodes ago is Louis the 11th is the Spider King.
Hey, Louis.
Yeah. But one of the reasons it's thought that Charles wasn't able to have this son, Charles of Orléans, was because he was suffering really badly from gout at the time, the disease of kings. And this causes this really painful, like, foot swelling, which generally doesn't lead to saucy times. So it doesn't really get you in the mood. But they managed. And they popped out two children at the very, very end. Mm. Charles of Orléans dies in 1465, basically just as Marie has given birth to their second daughter, Anne. Charles of Orléans is, like, a few miles away at Amboise, he's unable to make it back to Blois to meet his daughter, which is very sad. So, speaking of the king at the time, the Universal Spider, he is actually Louis's godfather, as well as being his second cousin, as well as being his future father-in-law, which is exciting. Lots of relations going. Now, apparently, Louis of Orléans made a very bad impression on the Spider King during his baptism, when the king was holding him, because as the godfather.
Or did he pee on him?
The baby wet himself onto the king's sleeve.
Ah!
prompting the king to rush through the ceremony and storm off in a huff.
No offense, but I cannot blame him for wanting to rush the ceremony if I had pee on me.
But, you know, not the best first impression. And if you think for one second that, like, the Spider King's not going to hold it against him, you haven't met the Spider King.
You're wrong.
And he becomes a bit of a villain, a bit of a boogeyman for Louis XII's childhood. We didn't mention it in his episode, but the Spider King is sometimes referred to as, like, an ogre, and he definitely plays this role in Louis of Orléans' childhood. So not only did the spider refuse Louis the customary princely allowance, which would have helped him sort of service the massive debt his family was in, but the spider also forcibly betrothed Louis to his daughter, Joan of France. Now, at first, this was fine. Like, it happened when Charles of Orléans was still alive. He kind of approved of it. But eventually, it became clear that Joan was not in the best state, let's say. She was considered deformed by the standards of the time. She grew up with a pronounced limp, a hunchback, and possibly dwarfism as well. Louis never actually met her during their childhood. She was kind of shut away in this castle where her father could visit her and every now and then and just to tell her how ugly she was, basically. It was not great. But, you know, Joan was at least looked after quite well by the family that did look. She was taken care of by a childless baron and baroness who had no children of their own. Aww. So they kind of, like, fawned over her and, like, doted on her. So that was good.
That's nice.
Louis, meanwhile, grew up properly, you know, at court, in the mix.
Yeah.
And received a sort of top-notch education.
As expected.
So, yeah. So his mother managed his affairs while he was growing up. She was a bit submissive to the king's will, let's say. Like, she was a bit of a pushover sometimes. So she failed to regain Louis his, like, allowance.
Well, it's hard when it's against the Spider King.
Yeah, so the Spider King was just cutting funding left and right. So as we know, the Spider King's intentions with his marriage may have been rather cynical. His doctors had informed him that his daughter Joan very likely would be sterile and never produce children. We don't really know on what basis they claimed this, but it was said to Louis, and he was aware of the fact that, according to the doctors of the time, she would not have children. And, you know, Louis eventually learned about this as well, apparently, because Louis grew up being very much against this marriage, because it looked like the King of France was basically ensuring that his line would die out by giving him a barren wife. Mm. A lot of sort of modern historians sort of chalk this up to later interpretation, up to propaganda, later spread by Louis XII, when he was trying to get his divorce eventually. But one thing we do know for certain is that Louis himself, while he had no quarrel with Joan personally, did not want to be married to her for other reasons as well. And by the time the marriage date was set, it does appear that the Spider King was insisting on the marriage out of spite. In a letter to one minister who protested the match, the Spider wrote, quote, "I have resolved to make the marriage because it seems to me that the resulting children will cost nothing to feed. Those who oppose it will not be sure of their lives in my realm."
Oh, bad day. Yeah.
And he also personally threatened Louis that he would sew him in a sack and toss him in the river if he refused to marry Joan. So there's some threats happening. So unlike her elder sister Anne, who was often present at court, Joan, as I said, he just kept out of the spotlight. So Louis didn't actually meet her until their wedding day.
Still, that's quite common anyway.
It is quite common, but it's like, usually that's common for like princesses that come from a foreign country. Like they're growing up in the same country. Like they're both in the Loire Valley, essentially, but they just never cross paths, I suppose.
Mm.
And at this stage, Louis is 14, Joan is 13, and the wedding ceremony happens in September 1476.
Okay.
But Louis was silent throughout the ceremony. Even when it came time to say the I do's, he refused to say anything.
Protest.
Which created a very awkward situation for the presiding bishop, who had the king breathing down his back.
I feel sorry for Joan.
I feel sorry for everyone in the situation except for the king. But the bishop sort of simply just pronounced them married and then hurried off. And afterwards at the reception feast, Louis spent most of the meal sobbing uncontrollably and refusing to even look at his wife. Yeah. So at the wedding, you know, Louis kind of displayed maybe a bit of defiance in the face of authority, but he also displayed... you know, he wore his heart on his sleeve. He's in touch with his emotions, I suppose. And that's not necessarily a bad thing for someone looking to be a politician. Later on, Louis does end up being a very sympathetic kind of king. And as part of this sort of wearing your heart on your sleeve kind of thing. And I imagine the Spider King very much saw Louis as a threat as he's like coming into manhood, because he's kind of like an older, more strapping, more handsome, you know, by Valois standards, it's a low bar version than the Spider King's own son, the Dauphin Charles, who's considered kind of deformed and ugly, kind of like Joan. So the only one of his children the Spider King considered worthy of his position was his eldest daughter, Anne of France.
Yes.
But she, of course, is a girl, so she's not eligible. So... Anne and Louis, Anne of France and Louis of Orléans, they're about the same age, and they were rivals from the very start. So on one occasion, there's this tennis match, and there's this dispute over whether or not Louis scored this point. And Anne, like, you know, the highest ranking noble lady present, was asked to sort of adjudicate this dispute, and she ruled against Louis.
Ooh.
And then Louis stormed up to her. Louis, by the way, had betted on this match, so he... And, you know, money's quite important to him. He's very much motivated to win this match. And Louis calls Anne a liar to her face. So Anne then turns to the Duke of Lorraine, who's standing next to her. And she asked, would you allow me to be insulted like that? And Lorraine then stepped forward and struck Louis on the face.
Damn.
And there was a brawl that had to be broken up by
I love that.
So you could see the seeds of a bit of a rivalry happening between Anne of France and Louis of Orléans. And as we know, Anne of France would go on to prove a worthy adversary as the power behind the throne and the de facto regent of her little brother, Charles VIII. A title that Louis thought himself entitled to, as he is, you know, the first prince of the blood.
Male.
And a man, yes. Now, I didn't really mention it in Charles or Anne's episodes, but Charles, unlike his sister, did actually have a lot of affection for his cousin slash brother-in-law, Louis of Orléans. He sort of idolized him, kind of like a big brother sort of thing. But of course, we know the way the wind blew, unfortunately. So 22-year-old Anne had this iron grip on her brother, who's 13. Mm-hmm. She controlled his every move. And she and her husband, Pierre de Beaujeu, trounced Louis at the meeting of the Estates General after the death of the Spider King to decide on the government of France. Louis was given like a generous kind of offer from this. He was made the governor of Paris, basically, and the governor of Champagne.
Nice.
So he got like a good deal out of it. But in Louis's mind, it wasn't. In Louis's mind, it wasn't enough, and the advisors around him were telling him that, like, you know, Anne and Pierre were mismanaging the finances, they'll destroy the kingdom, it'll be horrible, don't let a woman be in charge, that kind of thing. So Louis decided to take action, and he ended up sort of assembling a group of nobles to rebel. He also tried to kidnap Charles at one point, if you remember, like when he was on his way home from his coronation. But all this failed, and Louis ended up having to flee to Brittany, as we know, to the court of his first cousin, Duke Francis II, who also just happens to be the father of a young Anne of Brittany. And there are suggestions at this point that Louis and Anne of Brittany might get married, should Louis be able to divorce Joan, which is something that he thinks he might be able to do it at some point. So by fleeing to Brittany, Louis instigated a civil war, the Mad War, which saw French troops enter Brittany, defeat Brittany, and capture the Duke of Orléans at the Battle of Saint-Aubin de Cormier. This all happens in like the 5 years after Spider King dies. We've covered it before. Louis spends the next 3 years imprisoned at the Castle of Bourges.
Guess he's like his father, getting imprisoned.
Yeah.
Family tradition.
So meanwhile, Joan of France, the Duchess of Orléans, actually administers his territories in his absence. And she was she was every bit the dutiful wife. She did everything well. She dotted all the I's. She crossed the T's. She was, like her sister, very well educated. And, you know, more than capable to rule as a regent.
Nice.
And she was willing to do so despite the fact that her husband did not care about her ignored her. So at this point, she'd put up with years of infidelity, which had recently resulted in an illegitimate son named Michel de Bussy, who will end up being sent to the church and become the Bishop of Bourges, actually, funnily enough. The place where his dad's imprisoned. Despite her physical failings, Joan was very well-educated. She was also rather artistic. She could play the lute, and she dabbled in painting, and she was extremely pious as well.
Nice.
So she's very she's very Catherine of Aragon-coded, I think, especially given what happens to her. So the 17th century...
There's still mistresses like Catherine did.
And the thing is, like, it's not even, like, proper mistresses. Like, Louis doesn't have money. So just Louis can't afford to keep up, like, a mistress with an extravagant lifestyle. He's going to, like, brothels. Like, it's that kind of thing. Yeah. He's...
Don't you need money for brothels?
You do, but if you're a...
Not as much as a...
Not as much. Like, common men can afford brothels, you know. And Louis is... I say Louis's poor. Louis's poor for a prince. Like, he's still in the 1%. Compared to the rest of France. So let's not feel too sorry for the man.
Just because he couldn't afford to have 10 horses?
So... later historians do make a big deal about Louis' imprisonment, you know, how Anne of France makes him suffer in a dungeon. She's this, like, jealous woman who, like, was spurned by him at one point. And there's, like, a novel in the 1940s. It's called The Golden Porcupine. It's by Muriel Roy Bolton. And it's, like, this sort of tragic love affair between Louis and Anne. And it's, like, a whole will-they-won't-they relationship thing. There's no historical basis
for that. Anne probably would have been horrified if she read that.
Yeah. Also, Louis was not locked in a dungeon. He was in Bourges, which is one of...
Yeah, he was in nice quarters.
This was the castle that the Duke of Berry, like, did up with beautiful gardens and
stuff. Yeah, so, see, nice quarters.
So he's fine. He's fine.
Yeah.
And it was also the favorite castle of Charles the VII as well, actually. So it's like, you know, it's been a royal palace, like, in recent memory.
Yeah. Going to have top-notch stuff.
Exactly. So, yeah, it was well-fortified, also a place of luxury as well. And Louis was eventually released at the end of Charles's regency, because one of Charles's first acts, contrary to the wishes of his sister, was to release Louis of Orléans without any conditions as well. He was just released.
Nice.
And so Louis rode, I should say, to the side of the young king, and he collapsed in front of him with tears of gratitude, kissed his feet, all that sort of thing. He was very happy to be let free from the horrible prison of the lavish castle.
Oh, having to eat luxury food and a good bedding. Oh, how horrible.
So Charles VIII's reconciliation with Louis of Orléans came at the end of his regency, when he was starting to defy Anne and make decisions of his own. But I'm sure it would have relieved Anne in 1494 when Charles VIII decided to go on his reckless campaign into Italy, taking Orléans with him, by the way, and leaving Anne in charge again with no major challenges to a second regency.
Yeah.
So Orléans was very much a willing participant in the First Italian War, which is aimed at Charles claiming the throne of Naples. So for every Frenchman involved, there was a strong financial incentive with the promise of loot, strong spiritual incentive as well, as it's supposed to be a jumping off point for further crusades.
Oh my God, I imagine he was probably devastated when all their loot had to be left behind.
Oh yeah, definitely. But the war was also attractive to Orléans for a third reason, and that's Milan.
Oh yeah.
Through his grandmother, Valentina Visconti, both Orléans and his father before him, had a claim to Milan. So they believed themselves to be the rightful heirs of the Visconti family, who have died out at this point.
I don't know why, but every time I hear Visconti, I think of a biscuit.
You're thinking of biscotti.
Ah, that's why.
Yes. So Milan was sort of quote-unquote usurped by Francesco Sforza, a powerful sort of mercenary leader who married Bianca Maria Visconti, who was the daughter of the last, the only child, I should say, of the last Visconti Duke of Milan. But Bianca Maria was illegitimate. So So the Orléans branch of the family were like, nah, she can't inherit. So we have the claim. So the Orléans family, to this point, mainly because of lack of financial resources, had not been able to regain the duchy from the extremely wealthy, powerful Sforza family. Yeah. But they had been able to claim a small loyal territory in Asti, foothills of the Alps, which was Charles VIII's first stop upon entering Italy. Now, unfortunately for Louis, Charles VIII did not pursue his claim on Milan, not this time around, because his friendship with the Sforzas was part of what brought him to Italy and was a useful way of getting to Naples. So they had to play nice with the Sforzas for now. But to make matters worse, Louis and his contingent of the French army were actually held up in Asti when he fell ill. So he fell very ill. One of a series of terrible illnesses he suffered throughout his life. So he may have had some kind of chronic illness that just kept sort of debilitating him. So he completely missed out on the rest of the campaign to Naples. He had to stay behind.
Did he fall in love with someone there?
Louis struck up an unlikely friendship with the Duchess of Milan, Beatrice d'Este, who had made it her mission to charm the pants off any Frenchman who came her way. And these flirtations infuriated her husband, the present Duke of Milan, Ludovico Sforza, and they very much solidified the Orléans versus Sforza rivalry. Now, by the time Louis recovered and was able to lead troops again, Charles had, at this point, walked into Naples, leaving a trail of destruction, hangovers, and syphilis in his wake. And the Milanese, including Beatrice d'Este, were starting to turn against the French.
Yes.
So they were joining with Venice, the Papal States, and the Gonzagas of Mantua in a holy league to get rid of the King of France.
Oh, yeah. Such a good name.
And this is just the first of many holy leagues, by the way. So Beatrice was actually the regent of Milan during this time, as her husband Ludovico had suffered from what is either a stroke or a nervous breakdown, something like that. So after exchanging flirty letters for a few months, now suddenly Beatrice and Louis were at war. Louis decided to roll the dice and use his small force to make a bid for Milan. He's going for the jugular. Yeah, well, it does actually go quite well at first. Louis manages to occupy the fortress of Novara, which is one of the main strongholds protecting Milan. Then Louis was expelled by Beatrice, who managed to rally her husband's forces and drive him off to Piedmont. And from there, Louis tried to link back up with the main French army as Charles marched back towards France. But they weren't able to reach each other before the main French army was attacked by Francesco Gonzaga at the Battle of Fornovo. And Charles escaped mostly unscathed, or he and his army mostly unscathed. But as we know, they lost their baggage wagon and all of their loot.
I know. Sucks.
So that's the first Italian campaign, or Louis' involvement in it at least. Less than 3 years after that campaign in 1498, Charles VIII, as we know, perished from hitting his head on a lintel. So skipping forward to that, this is the third time he's done that on the podcast. It's very clumsy. And he and his wife Anne, Duchess of Brittany, have no surviving children. So by Salic law, we skip all the women. We go straight to the next male in line, which is Louis.
Yes.
King Louis the 12th. I nearly said 11th. King Louis the 12th. As we saw in Anne's episode, Louis the 12th, who was actually present at the Chateau d'Amboise when Charles died, spent the first day of his reign comforting her in her grief.
Yeah.
And then 3 days later, he asked for her hand in marriage. So Anne responded that if Louis was able to get a divorce from his current wife, Joan, because they're still married, within 1 year, if he does this within 1 year, she will marry him. And the reason that he really wants to marry her is, of course, because she is the Duchess of Brittany, and he really wants Brittany to stay within the royal, the French fold, yes. Although it is also clear that they were friends and Louis had, like, a genuine affection for her.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, he has zero affection for his current wife, unfortunately. He showed very little gratitude for all of the duty that Joan has shown him. By the way, she also was governing his lands while he was off campaigning as well. So Louis proceeded immediately with a lawsuit that was considered extremely scandalous for the time because of just how sort of low it stooped in trying to humiliate Joan, trying to discredit her. So the prosecution against her described in detail just how deformed and hideous she was, to the extent that Louis hadn't been able to bring himself to consummate the marriage, either on their wedding night or any point after. There were other grounds for an annulment. For example, Louis the 12th hadn't properly consented to the marriage. And also Joan's father, Louis the 11th, was his godfather, which made them, in the eyes of the church, siblings. But Louis the 11th had dispensations gotten from the Pope for these issues. So it ended up legally not mattering that Louis hadn't consented to the marriage. There was a papal dispensation for that, apparently. So the strongest point in Louis the 12th's favor was the non-consummation argument, which is something that hadn't been confirmed or denied up to this point. Now, Joan said the marriage had been consummated. And she stood strong with this point, and she argued that Louis was flat out lying.
Oh, yeah, well, come on. The Spider King probably would have 100% made sure they consummated.
Yeah, it is to this day quite very unclear who was telling the truth. But I suspect they did consummate. She had witnesses on her side, one of whom attested that the king had, quote, mounted his wife, quote, 3 or 4 times, which is a very pleasant way of putting it. So both sides are sort of playing dirty, using all this gossip to their advantage. And this is a very messy lawsuit on both sides and severely damaged the new king's reputation. But Louis the 12th had the trump card, which was a close working relationship with the current Pope, Alexander the 6th. If you remember, is Rodrigo Borgia. So in return for helping Louis out with his little problem, Pope Alexander, he made him an offer he couldn't refuse. I just think of him as the godfather. Pope Alexander expected his son Cesare Borgia, the leader of the papal army, to be given a prestigious French title and a prestigious French marriage as well. And also for the King of France to support the Borgias just in general against their enemies in Italy.
Yeah.
So Louis dubbed Cesare the Duke of Valentinois, and he arranged for him to marry one of Anne of Brittany's cousins, Charlotte d'Albret, who Charlotte not only despised the Borgias, but was also in love with someone else. So she had to be dragged kicking and screaming to the altar.
Aww.
Yeah.
Poor thing.
Pope Alexander was satisfied, so...
gave them the divorce.
He gave them the divorce on the grounds of lack of consummation, lack of consent, lots of other reasons. Louis is now a single man, thanks to the newest change of mind by the supposedly infallible church. So we will get to Joan's ultimate fate in part two of this episode, because by the way, this is a two-parter. Because there's a bit more in the ooh-la-la round. But Louis does at least give her a generous compensation.
At least she deserves.
Yeah. She's actually given a duchy. She's given the Duchy of Berry. So, you know.
Oh, nice.
I guess that's all right. Though she sadly does die fairly young, probably due to her health problems. In the meantime, Louis XII was free to marry Anne of Brittany, and we got into their marriage a little bit in Anne's episode. While it was far happier than Louis's first marriage, and Louis seemed to generally sort of love and be faithful to Anne, he's no longer visiting the brothels, and he doesn't have any mistresses. Good. The two did butt heads, though, over who their daughters should marry. Mostly their eldest daughter, Claude. The youngest daughter, Renee, isn't born until the very end of Anne's life.
Claude's a new name.
Claude is a new name. In fact, Louis very much likes the ancient Romans, so he's given his daughter sort of a Roman
I do like the name Claude.
Name. Louis wanted her to marry the next in line to the French throne, François of Angoulême, the future King Francis I. Mm. But Anne wanted Brittany to remain independent from France, so she was trying to get her daughter a Habsburg marriage.
Mm-hmm. She was so keen on those Habsburgs.
She's very keen on the Habsburgs. She's got a big crush on the Habsburgs, just generally. So this culminated in Anne, about 12 years into their marriage, separating from Louis and moving home to Brittany for about 5 years.
Yes.
But Louis eventually managed to win her back, and they had a second daughter, Renee.
Yes.
Which the name Renee means rebirth. So it's kind of like the rebirth of their love, I guess, which is kind of sweet.
Yeah.
The two do also have several sons, but they're all either stillborn or die in infancy. It's only their two daughters who survive. So while Louis the 12th is busy not having sons, a lot of his attention is taken up by grand political shenanigans, particularly focused around Italy, of course.
Yes, of course.
So Eliza, it's time to continue the Italian wars. Yay! Remember how sick of the Hundred Years' War you ended up being when we finally finished it? Yeah. Well, you might end up feeling the same way about the Italian Wars.
Is it as long?
It's not as long. It's only about 70 years long rather than 110 or whatever, 116 or whatever years. But it will go on. And you, at the end of, you'll be banging your head, being like, stop, go to Italy. But... But at least the conflict isn't happening in France. At least France itself is internally very much at peace in this period.
Yeah.
And also with the Italian Wars, we get the colour and pizzazz of the Renaissance. We get a lot of really interesting characters as well.
True.
Some of this stuff we'll be going into more detail when we do the Caterina Sforza episode on Patreon.
Yay!
Which will be out the week after Louis XII's second episode. But yeah. So Charles VIII's downfall in his campaign, the previous campaign, was that it shocked and alienated the people of Italy and made them hate rather than love him. Also, Charles's target had been Naples, which was controlled by the Aragonese royal family. So the campaign had upset Spain as well, and also the Habsburg allies. So it had been a bit of a train wreck for all of those reasons. So Louis chose a different tack. He is more interested in Milan, as we said.
Yeah.
He did also inherit the claim on Naples as well, though. So he's maybe looking for that long term. But
it'd be much easier to conquer Naples if you have Milan.
Yes, and Milan is a lot closer as well, just across the Alps. And also, the Spanish have no qualms about the French focusing on Milan, because, you know, it's distracting them from Naples, so it's like, whatever.
Yeah.
And Louis also has the Pope on his side, which is very important as well.
Yeah.
Cesare Borgia is one of his main military allies in this campaign.
Oh, yeah.
Another military ally in this campaign is Venice, surprisingly. Venice has changed sides again.
always.
Well, Venice is traditionally quite neutral, but they're getting more active militarily in Italy. I think it's because they've lost a lot of their eastern territories to the Ottomans, so they're more interested in kind of shoring up a base of power in Italy, and they become quite scary for the other Italian states this time, because like, oh, Venice.
Yeah.
Venice is on the warpath. Venice is no longer neutral. So yeah, Louis got Venice on side. He promised them basically a share of Milan's territory if they helped him.
Oh.
So that's what's in it for them. In fact, it was actually Venice who suggested to Louis that it was the right time to conquer Milan. So in addition to these new alliances, the French crown also have a consistently strong relationship with Savoy as well. So, which is just basically between France and Milan. So that's helpful as well. And Louis, of course, also has this personal territory in Asti, which he's been back and forth between when he was Duke of Orléans.
Okay.
Louis was already quite familiar with Italy at this point. He'd been back and forth a few times outside of the war, you know, and he'd done a bit of schmoozing with the Italian princes. And according to the Italian chronicler Pietro Valienti, he also did, quote, a bit of whoring in Italy as well.
Just a bit of whoring.
You know, back in his youth. So speaking of scandalous princes, at this point, the Duke of Milan, Ludovico Sforza, is hanging by a thread. Not only has he had terrible health problems, he's also considered a usurper by many. He sees the duchy from his conveniently dead nephew, Caterina Sforza's brother. And as you can imagine, this caused a bit of tension within the Sforza family, and Caterina and her uncle aren't really getting along. But Caterina was eventually able to put these qualms aside, and she supplied her uncle with troops from her husband's territories in the Romagna, the marshlands just south of Venice, because she's also afraid of Venice as well. And on top of that, Ludovico's beloved wife, Beatrice d'Este, had just tragically died young in 1497.
Childbirth?
I'm actually not sure what she died of. I will double check. She died due to complications due to pregnancy. So yeah.
Yeah.
You are correct. So yeah, Sforza is on the struggle bus. Once he's set up once Louis has set up his alliances and gathered his troops, it doesn't take much effort for him to bring Ludovico Sforza down. So imagine the green plains of Lombardy rolling down from the Alps, echoing with French cannon fire as Louis and his Italian marshal Gian Giacomo Trivulzio roll their way in from the west.
Great name.
They level the fortress of Rocca d'Arazzo, the fortress of Annone, and they occupy the cities of Valenza, Tortona, and Alessandria. And as the French approached Milan, a similarly beefy force of Venetians was also rolling in from the east.
Nice.
So some settlements were massacred, others rose up against the Sforzas in favor of the French and sort of greeted Louis XII with open arms. And on the 2nd of September, 1500, Ludovico Sforza fled Milan and Louis XII entered unopposed. So he spent the winter there, establishing a relationship with the local signoria, cooling tensions between the local factions.
Mm.
And the following spring, Sforza returned with a force of Swiss mercenaries to try to retake Milan. He recaptured the fortress of Novara. So it was time to deal with him again. At this point, Louis XII has gone back to France to go back and deal with stuff in France. But he still left some very competent commanders in charge.
Oh, good.
So the French army come back to Novara to lay siege as the Sforzas have occupied it again. And they bombard it with cannon fire, as you do. And the Swiss mercenaries inside the walls who are with Sforza, realize that there's also Swiss mercenaries outside the walls in the French army.
Both sides
have hired Swiss mercenaries. And the Swiss, as part of their contract, have that they are not going to fight one of their own. Yeah, they are not going to fight their fellow Switzerlanders.
Do they just stop fighting?
Sforza's Swiss pikemen all just left. They just walked out the city gates.
Damn.
And they left.
I like that camaraderie.
Yeah, but they were also like, we see the way the wind is blowing, so we're going to join the Swiss people on the French side.
Yeah.
And that really just tips the scales. There was also a bunch of German bandwagoners who joined the Swiss as well in leaving.
Like, oh, they're going, let's go too.
And this left Sforza with a tiny force of Lombards and Stradiotti, who are the skilled Albanian cavalry. So Sforza decided to try to flee again, as you do.
As you do.
So his army made a run for it when they thought the French weren't looking, but the French were looking. So they caught up to Sforza, they obliterated his army, and they captured him, sealing Louis XII's triumph as the new Duke of Milan.
Yes.
So Ludovico Sforza was sent to Louis XII in France, and he spent the remaining 8 years of his life imprisoned in the Loire Valley. So again, like, not the worst prison.
Yeah, not the worst place to be in prison, I have to say.
Louis XII followed the success up with a further conquest of Genoa, which had been a client state of France in the past. Been a bit rebellious lately for the king's liking. They had recently rebelled and installed a new anti-French doge who had massacred a bunch of French representatives. So Louis comes in to depose the doge.
We're having none of that.
Yeah, and he installs a French governor, but he decides to show mercy and spare the city from the ravages of his army. So there's this sort of triumphal entry into Genoa. Louis wears like white to symbolize peace, and he's greeted in the main church with a choir of 6,000 virgins, apparently.
Wow.
Who were all
how
dressed
they
in... They're all dressed... How did they have that many virgins? In Italy?
Just lying around.
Just our spare virgins over here. We just brought them all out for you. So the 6,000 virgins, they're all wearing white and they're all holding palm fronds as like a symbol of peace. And they're begging for the king's mercy. And he's like, I will show you mercy, blah, blah, blah. Even though, you massacred my dudes.
If it was 5,000 virgins, I wouldn't show mercy. But
exactly.
6,000 or 600?
5,999? No. This has to be 6,000 or nothing. So meanwhile, with the support of French troops, the dastardly Cesare Borgia also got his slice of the pie. But he's pulling less punches than Louis. He's not as merciful. He attacked Caterina Sforza's territory in the Romagna, which is a story for Patreon. And this gave France control over all of the vastly rich trade cities from the French Riviera all the way to Tuscany. Basically, they've got this huge territory in the north of Italy now. So essentially they've got the entire north coast of the western Mediterranean from Spain to Italy. And this was an unprecedented expanse of territory. Not since like Carolingian times has a king of France had this much territory in Italy that they actually seem to be holding on to as well.
Yeah.
And the next logical step is, of course, to get Naples as well. So Ferdinand of Aragon, he was happy that Louis was attacking Milan, but he's...
Now he's like, oh God, they've succeeded.
Quite nervous, yeah. So thanks to these new coastal holdings, Louis was able to build a massive Mediterranean fleet, commanded by his cousin Philip of Cleves, whose title was, get ready, the Lord of Ravenstein.
Oh, that's a good title.
Yeah.
That is a very good title.
So Ravenstein's fleet rolled into the Neapolitan city of Capua, and they put the city to the sword in typically brutal French fashion. And the French here fell into the old trap of getting carried away with the level of violence that they showed. Yeah.
Silly sausages.
So King Federigo of Naples, supported by Ferdinand of Spain and Maximilian von Habsburg, was able to expel the French once again. No luck for Louis XII in Naples, unfortunately. Now, writing about this conflict as it was happening, the great Florentine strategist Niccolo Machiavelli said, he said something to the effect of, the Italians don't know how to fight, but the French don't know how to govern. So, so yeah, it looks like it's just going to be back and forth like this forever. 3 to 4 years after the conquest of Milan, a couple bad things happen. Firstly, Louis XII's conflict with Queen Anne over their daughter Claude's betrothal kind of escalates to the point that Anne leaves and moves to Brittany for a bit.
Yeah.
And secondly, a few months before this happened, Pope Alexander VI died. Either from poison or malaria, depending on who you believe. And with his death came the downfall of Cesare Borgia as well.
Yeah.
Which is, once again, a story for another time. But Louis XII basically switches sides from the Borgias to their enemy faction in Rome, led by Giuliano della Rovere, who, with the support of the French cardinals, becomes Pope Julius II. There is another pope between him and Alexander VI, but he doesn't last very long, so we won't talk about him. But Julius... he was just really old. But Julius wasn't able to repossess all of the Borgia territories, because some of them up in Romagna were nabbed by Venice. And add to this the fact that the French had allowed them to conquer a good chunk of Lombardy, and Venice was now looking like, you know, a big bad threat, especially to the Pope. Big bad wolf, exactly. Well, big bad winged lion, which is the symbol of Venice.
Nice.
And yeah, now that France's back was turned, it looked like Venice might try to take over the whole of Italy. So the external great powers, France, Spain, the Holy Roman Empire, they all may have had their differences, but there was one thing they could all agree on, and that's that Venice is bad. The Venetians,
Venice cannot win.
They're tricksy little foxes. They can't be trusted. Plus, they've got lots of money and boats. And
they don't need more land.
And it would be nice to have all their money and boats for when we go on our glorious crusade to defeat the Ottomans. Eventually. We'll get to it eventually. In a rare show of solidarity, Louis XII managed to negotiate with Ferdinand and Maximilian to form a new league, the League of Cambrai. And, you know, Pope Julius came along as well. So in 1508, they signed this big treaty on the French imperial border in Cambrai, which is near Calais as well. So the English got to show up as well. They got to come too, as did the Hungarians and a few other Italian states, including Florence, Mantua, and Ferrara.
Wow, they really were a threat.
Yeah, so it's literally all of Europe versus Venice.
Oh, poor Venice. Like, yeah. Cheers.
And Julius
got
really
too greedy.
And Julius hammered the last nail into the coffin by putting Venice under papal interdict, which like essentially excommunicates the whole country. So it was now legal throughout the Christian world to assault, rob, and even murder any Venetian you saw.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Poor chaps.
So you won't be surprised to learn that the armies descending on Venice defeated them quite easily.
Once that many armies, that many countries. Yeah.
So Louis XII personally led a French army at the Battle of Vaillard. Penetrating through not just Venice's recent acquisitions, but its historic territory in the Veneto. And Machiavelli said of this battle, quote, "It took the Venetians one day to lose what had taken 800 years to conquer." Machiavelli has so many great quotes. I'll be using them
He really
liberally.
Does.
So not only had they lost territory, but the Venetian banks collapsed, and it looks like this might be the end for the floating city. So the Venetians retreated back to their lagoon. They gave up almost all of their territory on the mainland. They closed their eyes. They waited for the inevitable, you know, gunfire from the French. But no army appeared on the horizon. And I'm sure it'll not come as a shock to you that once all of these armies get to Italy, they then start fighting among themselves. Yes.
Yeah.
So Louis XII did manage to de-escalate tensions between him and the other commanders. He mainly did this by promising to support Maximilian, who's just become emperor at this point, to put his son Philip on the Castilian throne. Because if you remember, Isabella of Castile has recently died. Maximilian wants his son Philip to be ruling Spain on behalf of his wife, Joanna, because she's mad and she can't rule, whatever. Ferdinand is like, no, I want to govern this realm for my daughter, you know. So there was a dispute over that between the Spanish and the Habsburgs. But Louis XII sides with the Habsburgs in this dispute in order to kind of get them more on side.
Yeah.
And, you know, this must have made Anne of Brittany happy that he's supporting the Habsburgs. But Louis could not win over Pope Julius, who had turned against them. Because he now feared that France's increasing presence in Italy would result in another situation like the Avignon papacy, where the Pope was essentially under the French boot. Yeah. So Julius told Louis XII, quote, I don't want to be your chaplain. I'd rather be a martyr. So he's like, yeah, I'd rather die than let you control me by taking over all this Italian territory. So taking advantage of this new rift in the League of Cambrai, Venice swooped in and they signed a treaty with the Pope. Which lifted the interdict that they'd been placed under and allowed them to regain some of their lost territory as well. The wind totally got taken out of the league's sails because they'd now lost the support of the Pope. Not only that, but Julius decides to make a new league, the Holy League. He's calling this one because it's holier. And he invites everyone now to unite against France. And this works. Because Louis XII was seen as the biggest threat at this time, because he had all this Italian territory that everyone thought he maybe shouldn't have, the Holy League was formed against him in October 1511, and the Holy Roman Empire and Spain and England, you won't be surprised to learn, they all jumped on the bandwagon.
Of course.
Yes. One of France's allies is Scotland. Allies. They'll be allies to the bitter end. And Scotland does invade England at this time, actually. Henry VIII also simultaneously invades France as well. But we'll get to that. So France, they did win a final victory in the War of League of Cambrai, the Battle of Ravenna in April 1512, but the victory was hollow as the French general Gaston de Foix, the Duke of Nemours, who was nicknamed the Thunderbolt of Italy, which is a great name.
Cool.
He was slain in battle, sadly. So it was a victory, but they lost their best commander. Meanwhile, the Swiss mercenaries ended up betraying France, pledging 6,000 troops, so not 6,000 virgins, 6,000 troops to the Pope's cause. And this led to them recapturing Milan.
Oh.
Yeah. So Ludovico Sforza was dead at this point, but his and Beatrice d'Este's teenage son, Massimiliano Sforza, came out of exile as a teenager and was made Duke of Milan. So Julius, who is known as the Warrior Pope, by the way, mainly for this war, he died the following year in 1513, and the Holy League, just as quickly as it had formed, it collapsed again. But it had done its job, and it had expelled the French. And so after all of that, Louis XII had technically lost to the Sforzas, but Milan did remain severely weakened after two decades of war. France had been bamboozled by the Pope's trickery, they'd lost for the moment, but they will be back.
Nice.
Yeah. Louis XII, however, will not live to see the third invasion of Italy that the French were already planning. So his wife, Anne of Brittany, is already dead at this stage, leaving Louis with his two daughters, Claude and Renee. Shortly after Anne's death, Louis ensures that 14-year-old Claude both inherits the Duchy of Brittany and marries Francis of Angoulême, the heir to France. Contrary to all of Anne of Brittany's wishes. And by doing so, Louis ensures that despite his lack of sons, the remaining Valois kings of France will all be his descendants one way or another through his daughter.
Oh, that sounds smart.
But Louis hasn't totally given up on having sons because he is now, once again, a single man. He's also got a war to resolve, specifically the war with England. In 1514, in his efforts to resolve this war, in which Henry VIII very briefly charges into France, Louis negotiates with him and ends up marrying his sister, Mary Tudor.
Yep.
Yeah. So this is not the Mary who will become Mary I of England, or Bloody Mary. Yeah. That's Henry's daughter.
Yeah.
But Henry did name Mary I after this sister. Because she was his favourite sister. The favourite of his two sisters. His other sister, Margaret, was the Queen of Scotland. And also the grandmother of another Mary, Mary Queen of Scots as well.
Yes.
So we will most certainly get more into Mary Tudor in Ooh La La. The age gap between her and Louis. Yeah. Her being 18, Louis being 52 at this stage. It was considered a bit much even for the time, surprisingly. And the poets and minstrels of the time had a field day describing how chuffed the King of France was when he received his little English rose. Louis received her in the town of Abbeville, where he married her on the 9th of October 1514, before she received him, as it were, in the bedchamber. But a mere 12 weeks later, Louis XII died. Supposedly, if you believe the minstrels of the time, he died of overexertions in the marital chamber with his new young wife. In reality, though, Louis XII was suffering badly from gout, just like his father had.
Of course.
So I'm not sure how much he was even able to do anything in the bedchamber, let alone walk. But he died... He died at the Hôtel de Tournelle in Paris on New Year's Day, actually, in 1515. Oh. Just under a year after Anne of Brittany died.
Oh.
Yeah. So it hadn't been long. And he was the first king to die in Paris, actually, since the death of your favourite, Charles VI.
Oh.
Yeah. The others have died in the Loire.
Oh, yeah.
So the funeral, therefore, took place in the local cathedral of Notre Dame. Before his body was carried a few miles to the Basilica of Saint-Denis, where it was to be buried alongside Anne of Brittany and his royal ancestors. Although there was a bit of a kerfuffle during the funeral procession. The cart that was carrying the king's coffin broke down.
Ooh.
Also, when they finally got to Saint-Denis, there was an argument between the monks of Saint-Denis and the king's servants over who should keep the gold cloth that covered the coffin. So the monks won, by the way. So
of course.
It was a bit of an inauspicious funeral, and it was very poorly financed as well, because the new king, Francis I, weirdly didn't spend that much money on Louis XII's funeral. He didn't want to draw too much attention to the very popular king who had just died.
Yeah.
Don't pay attention to that guy. He was kind of rubbish. I'm much better than him. But we'll get to Francis I and his vanity in his episode. Nonetheless, Louis did get a magnificent tomb built in the Italian style, of course, which we'll be looking at next episode. So that is Louis XII's life. And next episode, we will be getting further into detail, particularly about how he ruled at home. Because it is, he is quite a reforming king. He was there a lot. We just didn't get into it because I wanted to save it for the rounds.
Okay.
But what do you think of him so far? Just purely based on what
he seems interesting. Interesting, definitely. I don't know, I think I like him, but at the same time, I'm like, I need a bit more.
I mean, he's quite active. He's running around a lot.
Yeah, I do like that.
Lots of war.
True.
Yeah.
Do you like that? It's just, it's like, he did all that, but then he was like, he lost it. And you're like, damn. Milan.
That's the thing. Although, spoiler alert, it won't take too much for Francis to regain a lot of what he lost.
No, oh, nice.
It's very back and forth with the French in Italy. Basically, it's very easy for them to invade Italy because they have a very good army. But then they have very bad governors, though. So that's the... As Machiavelli said, that's the problem.
Yeah.
What do you think Louis's chances are of being spared the guillotine?
I don't think it's high.
High?
Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, I have some very interesting details about his life and reign coming up next episode, which will give us a much better idea of him, and which may change your mind. But for now, that is the episode done.
Okay.
And that is going to be au revoir for me.
And goodbye for me.